So tomorrow, the silence at breakfast will be broken, and you'll have a good opportunity to talk and share with each other. And then we'll have the final session before lunch, and then I'll talk for just 30 minutes about meditation and daily life. And so this is, in a way, the final talk, a full talk. And so what I wanted to do during this talk was first answer some questions. I was given some notes, and I felt the points that are raised are very good points, and so I wanted to share this with everybody. And so one question which often is asked is, in terms of meditation in daily life, is it better to do just one thing, or is it okay to do different things? So, for example, in a day, should I do a little bit of breath meditation in the morning, maybe a little loving kindness in the afternoon, or should I just keep to one thing? And so I think in terms of meditation in daily life, if we have a kind of a regular schedule, I think we can go two different ways. One way is actually to trust where our attention goes. So if the attention goes to the breath, we go there. If it goes to the loving kindness, we go there. So when we're trusting in our own practice, trusting where the attention anchor. And that, I think, is totally fine. And then within that, you can play with what is in the foreground, in the background, according to condition. But it is also true that in daily life, you might want, in a way, to continue with the training. And here, you might want to, in a way, not think that you just explore the meditation on retreat, but you might want to continue the training and explore the meditation in daily life. And then it's a little bit like a training where you can explore. And so you can decide for a week, I will just do loving kindness, and that's what I will explore. Or you might decide to do something else. So I think there is, in a way, two ways to go about it. One is to really trust the attention and just follow that and not worry so much, do I do the same thing or not? Because any attention, any mindfulness is fine. But then there is also the other aspect, which if you want to explore, if you want to train and to kind of make a little kind of a workbook, in a way, nearly like a workbook, you know, I want to explore this theme or I want to explore this practice. And then in a systematic way, you would go about that. And then there you can notice, if I do this for a week, what kind of difference does it make? And so that's what I would say about this. Then there was a question, a difficult question actually. How can one help a young child to cultivate compassion and altruism? And that, I think, is a little complicated because it depends on the child and it depends on you. That in one way, in the same way, we cannot force ourselves to be altruistic and compassionate. I mean, we can try to force ourselves. But generally, the idea is, how can I incline myself toward that? And I would think it's the same with a child, that you cannot force them to be altruistic and compassionate. I mean, this is something, nowadays it's a little different, but in the old days, you were told to eat your soup because people were starving in Africa. And you thought, what difference does it make? You know. So I think that what I would ask, suggest, is that child already inclining toward that? What are the conditions that make them incline toward altruism, toward compassion? Are they compassionate when their mother suffers? Are they compassionate toward animals? Do they think of others? Do they have this movement? And in a way, how can you, in a way, you have the same movement? I think in a way, if you yourself do it, if you have that inclination, then often the child will see you in action and then will see how it is, how it works. Otherwise, I think it's you would have to be very creative to find a way where that could be the inclination without forcing the child, because then it might have the opposite effect. So I would say it's also working on ourselves. If we are like that ourselves, very likely the child can also be inspired to do that. But then you have to see the condition of the child. And also you have to see how is the child responding, reacting to feeling torn. And so is it that when they are in a good feeling tone, that actually they look more kind and more compassionate? And is it that when they are in pain, they cannot think of anything else? Or is it that when they are in pain, they can understand the pain of others? So I think it's really complicated. It's really, I think working with children, it's really one needs to be very creative and actually bring a lot of mindfulness to the condition. And then there was an interesting point about somebody who works with people who are dying. And so he or she said that, you know, when people are dying, she's there or he's there for them. And in a way, the person had the impression that they were not doing possibly enough in terms of being compassionate or feeling compassion. And I think it's very important to see that there are very many different aspects to compassion, that often you have compassion where actually you don't do anything. Because of course you have what I would call creative, active compassion when you do something, but I think a lot of the time you cannot do anything. You cannot do anything to the suffering of the person. You cannot do anything to the situation of the person. But one thing you can do is to be very calm, very present with them. And that is compassion. It doesn't mean that you have a lot of feeling, but it just means you're really there with the person, totally present to them in that moment, so that they can be feel that they be accompanied. So often we might have a feeling of we need to have something which is more deep felt or it's more expressive. But to me, at the moment of dying or when somebody is very ill, the only thing we can do is to endure with them, is to be with them in their suffering, in that moment. And what we can give is actually just to be calm, just to be balanced, and being able to be with that, being able to be with that situation. So I don't think that the person needs to do more than the person is doing already, because just being there is actually already compassion in action. And then what I wanted to to look at today, two things. One thing, I wanted to look, there is something called in Buddhism, the four great efforts. And we've already looked at actually two. So two I won't look at tonight. So I will read them, and then I will look at the two I want to look at tonight. So in a way, these four great efforts are about the awareness of condition and how to transform before and during. So that's the way it is stated. Sustain positive states once they have arisen. Enable positive state that I have not yet arisen to arise. Let go of negative states once they have arisen. Prevent negative states that have not yet arisen to arise. So I don't want to look so much at the last two because we have covered that quite a bit. But as you go back home tomorrow, I want you to reflect a little on the first two. Sustain positive state once they have arisen. And I think, in a way, when you hear this, sustain the positive state, you might have the impression that, yes, there is a positive state and I need to push it, I need to kind of make it, I need to do a lot of things so that it will continue. And actually, this one requires no effort. That's what is interesting with this one. That actually the only thing it needs is for us to be aware. That actually what this asks of us is to be aware, oh, I am peaceful, I am calm, I am happy, I feel well, I feel clear. And just to really fully be aware of it, be fully aware of how it feels to be calm, to be clear, to be compassionate, whatever it is. And what is interesting is that if we are aware in that way of the state itself, actually it will continue longer. Because actually it's kind of nearly like it's self-sustaining. If you're just aware of it, you are in it, just by being with it, actually it continues on its own. And here there is an interesting point in terms of what I would call meditative states. That when we are on retreat, sometime when we are in daily life, but especially on retreat, we might experience what we might call a meditative state. And that might have different aspects. But one of the one we often experience is what I would call a quiet and clear state. So you're sitting in meditation, or you're doing the walking meditation or lying down meditation, and suddenly you feel very quiet and clear. And you don't have to do anything. Generally, it just happens that you feel quiet and clear. And often, our first reaction to this is to think, oh, how can I go deeper with this? And then immediately it goes. When actually, the only thing you need to do is nothing. You just need to hold it. And in a way, it's kind of holding the state like a mother would hold a child. If you hold the child too tight, it's going to cry. If it's too loose, it's going to fall. And it's the same here. The state arises, you feel the quietness and the clarity, and can you just be with it? Not do anything with it, just experience it. So that you know, oh yeah, I can experience myself like this. And then in a way, it's kind of like you accompany the state. And then at some point, of course, it will disappear. Because the energy, in a way, the practice that made it happen, now the energy has gone. So that too is impermanent. And I think part of the sustaining of the positive state is to know, as it happens, it is not going to last. But I don't need to do anything special. I just need to accompany it as it lasts. And so what we have to be careful after is trying to reproduce exactly the same one. It will happen again in whatever way. And then again, we can be with it. We can accompany it. We can welcome it. And so what we have to be careful also is that sometime you might have an insight. You are on a retreat or whatever, and then you really see something so clearly. And the sustaining of it is just to be aware of it. It's just you kind of, you see something clearly, you continue with the seeing clearly. And then at the moment you really feel, I know this. I know this so well. And then, like all things, at one point, the energy goes. And then you try to remember, oh yes, I saw this so clearly, and that's what I saw so clearly. And then you try to repeat it. But if you saw it so clearly, you don't have to repeat it, you know, in whatever way it will come back or not. But you have known it. So I think we have to be careful that, in a way, the positive state is to be experienced and not so much to that they have to stay and be there all the time. So then what you're left with is you know something, but you're not going to know it as when you experience it. We have to be very careful with insight, for example. Or sometimes when we sit in meditation, suddenly you have this feeling that you love everybody. So suddenly you feel your heart is open and there is nobody you cannot love, even the person you have really difficulty with. And they kind of like seems benign. It's like there is little benign cloud. Everybody is in it. When generally we think, I like those one, but that one, no way. You know, so generally our love is a little restricted. There is a little kind of border. And here you feel there is no border. And it's an amazing experience. And it's wonderful to be able to experience that, to just be with it, a company experiencing that. But that too will dissipate. And then you'll go back to, I don't like that one, but this one. But you know it's possible. I think this is what is very important to sustain the positive state is really to be aware of them, to really inhabit them, to experience them. But experiencing them, knowing at some point, they will pass. And so in a way, in our daily life, I think one of the key is to really be aware of just that, yes, positive state happen. I can experience peace, kindness, wisdom, etc. I can experience this myself. Can I not take it for granted? Can I really know it? And through really knowing it, sustaining it until it passes, like all things. So that's what the sustaining is about, is actually being with, really being in the experience. And so in a way, you're not forcing the positive state, but you let it happen. It's nearly like you let it infuse you while it's there. And so you could have this kind of experience also. I remember many years ago, I was helping a little with keeping my niece. And she was young, she was 6, 7. And so she would stay with my mother downstairs, and then she would come up time to time to stay, to visit us with my husband. And so one day, we had worked in the garden, we were tired upstairs, and so we're in the living room, and we were listening to some music, Schubert. And we were just quietly listening. And then suddenly she burst in. And then she looked at us sitting quietly listening to the music and she says, I'm going to dance. And then she started to dance on the Schubert music. It was not the Bolshoi, but she, you know, doing her thing. And then the only thing we had to do to sustain it was to look at her. So she would check that we were looking at her. And we would be kindly looking at her, interested, etc. So she checked time to time. And then she checked, they're still here. Okay, so then she would continue the dance. And it lasted about 25, 30 minutes. It was amazing. It was this really beautiful moment of just sharing the music, sharing the beauty with her. It was very beautiful. And then after 30 minutes, she had to go down to eat, so she went down. And to me, what was interesting in that is she so enjoyed it, and we so enjoyed it, and we did not have to do anything but just be there, really be present to it. And then, of course, after that, the next day, she wanted to reproduce the moment. And so she kind of, you know, we had to listen to the music, and it was, that's not right, that's not right. And I thought it was sweet. She wanted to recreate this beautiful moment, but we could not, because it had passed. We could have other moments, but we could not have the same one. And then there is another effort, and this one is interesting, to enable calm, clarity, creativity, compassion to arise before it has arisen. So in a way, kind of hear it saying, can you help the condition so that the positive state will arise? And I think that's really what we are doing here on a retreat. We really are cultivating what I would call the tools of awareness. So what we're doing here is actually working toward that one. The fact that we're trying to cultivate conditions so that in daily life, we might be more likely to be kind, to be peaceful, to be stable, to be balanced. It doesn't mean we will be like that all the time. But it means, again, there can be this inclination, there can be this movement towards it. And so this is one of the reasons, actually, I present different things on a retreat. Because I feel each of these methods are actually tools of awareness. And that each have a slightly different effect. So in a way, you could look at each like the mindfulness of the breath, generally, if it works for you, as a stabilizing influence. The breath can really stabilize ourselves. And so in a way, in daily life, if we suddenly feel agitated, sometimes it's good to, okay, let me come back to the breath, so that then one is a little more calm. Or, for example, sometimes we can get really lost in abstraction. And then, if we come back to the body, I think that really can help us to come back to the experience. And so this is something we can consciously do, that we go again and again to texture, to sensation, that we kind of feel the key of the house, or that we feel the feet on the ground. And then if we do that, we're more likely to be present instead of being lost in abstraction. Or listening. I think listening can be such a practice, because the listening generally will open us, really open us in a different way than if we focus on the breath or focus on the body. And so in a way, sometimes when we feel really close, to in a way, oh, trying to listen to the sound. And then to listen to the sound, if we can, without discrimination, without grasping, to just listen. In a way, listening to the sounds as we would listen to the music of life. So to see, in a way, the sound, to open to life through the sound. And it's the same with the loving kindness. If we incline, if we cultivate the loving kindness, then it starts to make us see people in a different way. I have a friend, and she used to work with somebody who was really difficult. And so the person would upset her very fast. And what she did was to do loving-kindness meditation before she went to work with him. So she would do 30 minutes of loving-kindness. And she said for at least 30 minutes, she would be okay. And then he would start to upset her. But it went, she had much more space, she had much more calm to be with it. So in a way, to see that each practice will bring a little kind of direction. So will kind of help us to cultivate the muscle, we could say, of loving kindness or rejoicing or compassion. And then it's more likely that the thing will happen, that the thing will manifest. And then if it manifests, then we can again be able to more sustain it. And so I think this is something which is important, not just to focus on when we grasp or when we stuck, but also to really focus on when we experience this positive state. Also, what is it that helps us to bring this state about? Because we are capable of experiencing them, of manifesting them. And it's the same with the questioning. I don't know how you found it or if it was helpful, but I think sometimes, again, cultivate the questioning can help us to turn things around. Because sometimes we can get so stuck. And then you ask yourself, but is this true? What is this? And suddenly the thing opens. And you can look at it in a different way. So to really see these different things as tools of awareness. So in one way, you can generally, in practice in daily life, use the one that works for you. But then you also know that time to time, according to condition, you can use this tool of awareness to enable you to so that the positive state are more likely to arise. And then what I wanted to look at is to look a little to look a little more carefully at this mindfulness. So nowadays we talk a lot about this mindfulness, this awareness. And so the word is sati, the ancient word. And so I wanted to see, but what is it we're trying to do? We go back to daily life and we want to be aware. But how do we want to be aware? This is something we have to be extremely careful. That actually, we have to be first very careful that the awareness, mindfulness, actually does not become judgment. So judging is useful. It helps us to be wise, to discriminate. It's a creative function. But sometimes it becomes like a pattern, like a habit. And we tendency to judge ourselves, judge others. And so the problem with judging is that it makes us in a way separate from what is going on and us judging it. And so what we have to be very careful is not to use awareness that way. So you are here on retreat, you cultivate mindfulness, and then you go home, and I need to be mindful. And then it's like a radar. You're kind of looking. Am I mindful enough? Am I kind enough? Am I compassionate enough? And then generally you have this idea of a perfect awareness or a perfect loving kindness. And then often it doesn't match. So we have to be careful. This is not what we're trying to do. We're not using the mindfulness, the awareness to then constantly judge what is going on. Actually, the mindfulness, the awareness is to help us to be more inside the experience, not separate from it and judging it. But actually, it's to help us to be more in it. And also, it's not any kind of mindfulness. It's a caring and careful mindfulness. So in a way, it's kind of trying to approach the situation in a certain way. So it's kind of really the mindfulness to be in the experience again in this kind, open, clear way. So I think this is something we have to be very careful about when we bring this practice to daily life, that actually we don't use the mindfulness or the compassion to accuse ourselves or to accuse others. When I used to live in a community, a Buddhist community many years ago, I found it funny. We used to accuse each other. You were not mindful enough. You kind of make sounds with the door, or you're not caring enough. You did not wash the cups or whatever. So in a way, we would use all these to accuse each other that we actually were falling short. And I don't think that's the idea. The idea is really to see that often the idea of the mindfulness first is actually to remember our intention. This is the first meaning of sati, actually to remember. So part of the thing about mindfulness in daily life is to remember to be mindful, but not in order to give ourselves a hard time, but in order to be more caring and careful. And I found one interesting example is, let's say, I don't know if some of you drive, but I drive. So when I drive, I try to be mindful, because I think it's a good idea to be mindful when you drive. But what I found amazing is that I drive and I catch myself thinking of something else. And I don't think, oh, I am a terrible person. By now I should be able to be mindful all the time. But I find, isn't it weird to think of something else when you're driving? It's a little dangerous. So in a way, you come back. I come back to the mindfulness for safety for myself and others, because I care for myself and others. So I don't give myself a hard time. I just say, whoa, be careful, be here, be present to what's happened. Because if you think of something else, you might not see what something comes surprising. And so it's the same when we are with others. In a way, the mindfulness is for us to be together, to share together, to be aware of the others. And so in a way, again, trying to bring the mindfulness in the listening. And that's interesting. How do we listen? Tomorrow you're going to have the opportunity to talk, to share with each other, to listen to each other. But how do we listen? And generally, I would say we listen in three ways. The first one, we listen, but we wait for the person to stop so we can say something so much more interesting. So we wait a third that they stop. We listen to them a third. And a third, we try to remember what we're going to say, which is so much more interesting. So this is what I call listening. Another way we listen is that we look in the right direction. They talk to us. And then you think of totally something else. And then when they ask you, what do you think? You have no idea what they said. I mean, your ear works. And there it shows there was no mindfulness. Because if there had been mindfulness, you would have heard. But because there was no mindfulness and you were somewhere else, you did not hear. Then the third way to listen, we listen, but then we grasp. And so we exaggerate what they're saying, which generally is not very helpful. And so then, in daily life, to me, this is a wonderful practice. How can I just listen and not prepare, not wait for them to stop, but just listen? And so in a way, this is a great gift we give, to totally listen to somebody. But what is interesting, if we do this, when come our turn to speak, we generally say something so relevant, so much wiser, so much compassionate, and so much appropriate. And that's what is interesting with the mindfulness, is that if we cultivate it, it allows our creative potential to blossom, to activate. And this can you can really see when you do this listening, meditative listening, that often you surprise yourself. You've not thought about this before, but in the contact with the person, in the fully listening in a caring way, then your creative potential is activated. And so in a way, again, this is a wonderful practice we can bring in daily life. And so in a way, we can also bring this to our work. This is interesting. Again, you could bring the mindfulness to working. And I'm going to be aware all the time, all the time, all the time. And then you feel all tense because you have to be aware all the time. But again, it's more this skillful mindfulness and to notice how do I work? Do I work in such a way that I'm always ahead of myself? So I barely start something, I'm already thinking of the next thing. Barely start something, already thinking of the next thing. So in a way, I am only half here and half ahead. And this can be so satisfying to actually be totally here now. And then when the work is finished, it's finished. You don't keep it and then you go to the next thing. You're totally there and then to the next thing. And also to see that I think there is so much thing with work, the way we approach the work, the way we are defined by it, the way we identify with it, the way we do it. And so in a way, with the mindfulness, to really, in a way, look at all the different aspects, not in order to judge ourselves, but in a way, in order to understand. And this is an important part of the mindfulness. It's not just to see something, but part of the mindfulness is to understand what is happening. In a way, to understand our own condition within the outer condition. So how can I be in this situation? How can I be with this difficult person? How can I understand? How can I help the situation? So it's kind of, in a way, seeing not the mindfulness as staring at something, but as really, in a way, encountering it, going inside it, and seeing its different aspects. And so to see that there are many different aspects to the mindfulness. And so to see that when we go back to daily life, this is going to be a very different condition than being on retreat, being on silence, to have a schedule. But to see that as we go back in daily life, we can also continue the exploration. And I think this is why it's so important to see that when we are on a retreat, in a way we are building the muscle of the creative awareness, on the mindfulness. But that actually it will only become, you could nearly say, true mindfulness, true creative awareness, when we can activate it in our daily life. Because it's not just on the cushion. We can be mindful on the cushion. But what I think is very important, how can I bring this quality of caring, of carefulness, of being attentive, of being inside the experience, in such a way where I don't force myself, but it's more like an invitation, like a welcoming to what is going on, trying to understand, to meet the condition. So, that's what I wanted to say today. Are there any questions? Or, yes.
I wasn't sure. wanted to ask about listening. And sometimes, like, if you're listening to people at work or friends and they have a lot of problems, or just listening, like, mindfully, it can be very draining also. So I'm wondering, kind of like, how to listen skillfully or so on.
I think, in a way... When I talk about listening, I think it's a very important training, a very important practice. And at the same time, of course, there is some limit to it. I mean, there is two things here. There is a thing that somebody might want to talk to you, and so you listen to them. At the same time, you cannot listen to them all the time. There is also that the fact that there is a certain kind of, you know, time limit and energy limit and things of that nature. So what is important here is how can I listen but not grasp at it? That, I think, is the key. Because sometimes we listen, but then once a person stops talking, then we continue to think about it and we continue to be worried about it or we continue to be with it. When I think one of the important elements of this meditative listening is that when you're there, you totally listen. And at the same time, as you listen, you know you might not be able to help them. I think we have to be careful that compassionate listening doesn't mean you can resolve their problem. Sometimes you can help them, sometimes not. Sometimes you can just listen. I mean, there was this person who would come to me with all her problems. And every time I used to give her lots of different solutions. And then she never applied my solution. And then I realized she did not want solution. She just wanted me to listen. And in the listening, I was just showing her I loved her. That's all she needed. She did not need me to sort her out, actually. So once I understood this, it was much easier. I did not need to think about different solutions. I just needed to be there. And to listen in a kind way. But once a person left and stopped, I would let it go. Because it was earthing. And I could not do anything with it. So I think this is, in a way, the key. Can we listen and really be there for what the person said, but actually not grasp at it? So that then it continue afterward. And I think this is... not easy. The listening part is relatively easy up to a point. What we also have to work is to live it. I totally listen to it, now I live it. And then if they want to talk to me again about it, I can listen to it, and now I live it. And that, I think, is also a practice, actually, to live it.
You're probably familiar with Zen practice of just sitting. Is there a creative engagement element in that practice, or is it different from the kind of mindfulness that you teach?
Okay, so in the Zen tradition, generally you have two main branches. One branch is what I was teaching today, which is called Imje Son, Li Chin Chan, or Koan Zen, where you use a question or you use a koan. And so this is quite an active type of meditation. And then you have another branch, which is generally called Soto Zen, Cao Tung, and it's actually often called just sitting, or it's also called silent illumination. And so in a way, it's a very different approach. And both of them accuse each other of being like this or like that. You know, so the just sitting one say the other one are too active, and then the active one are saying the other one they're too passive, etc., etc. I think it's just a different way to look at the practice. And so with the one we did today, it's a very active one, actually. But it has the same result. as any other practice, which has anchoring and questioning, you become more aware anyway. And then with this one, the just sitting. So in a way, the slight thing you could see problematic with the questioning, the active one, is that actually you tense around, I must be enlightened, I must be enlightened, I must find, I must. So there is the tension from really being so active. And in a way, the slight problem with the just sitting is generally the vagueness. Because there you're told, no anchor, nothing, you just sit there, you don't do anything. But not doing on anything is doing something, in a way. The doing of not doing is still doing. So here the problem is that you can just become a little vague. But the idea, I think, is a little similar, but done in a different way, because there the anchor becomes a sitting itself. So in a way, you anchor in the body. So often in that practice, there are very lots of teaching about the posture. In other practice, they don't teach so much the posture, but there, because you have so little anchor, the anchor becomes the posture. And then, I mean, those people have fantastic posture. They have the best posture. I mean, they're really like amazing. Whenever I have the just sitting people, yeah, great posture. So that becomes the anchor, the posture. And then the questioning is done in a very different way. It is done through this faith. I mean, actually, that practice is based on the great faith that you are awakened already. So then the only thing you need to do is to sit there and in a way emanate the awakening by just sitting there. So actually, that practice, I think, is really based on the great faith. And you often have the slightly similar result, that if you do this and if you apply yourself, then generally you become a little more aware, you become more compassionate. I think often you do it directly or indirectly, but you have a little the same effect slightly. But it is true, the technique is very different. And I think the technique of no technique actually is suited for different people. Because that's what I have seen with people. I've seen people who really need something, really need an anchor, really need an activity. And at the same time, I have seen people who really need to have this spaciousness. They need to have this just sitting. They don't want to be told to do anything. They just want to sit there. And so I think it's also, because of course they're convinced that they have the best method, of course. But personally, I think it's more temperamental. That some people will be better with something active, directive, anchored in that way. And some people will be much better with something which is more spacious, which is more open. And also I think at different times. Because that's what I see among my friends, that if they don't a practice like Upandita or Mahasi Sayadaw or labeling, which is quite kind of a little kind of tense making sometimes, then they will go to a just sitting thing to kind of balance it out. Or the just sitting, they become a little vague, so they have to go over there to kind of bring a little kind of more humph in it. So I think also, sometimes it's temperamental, and sometimes I think it's also a question of balance. That you can go a little this way, and then you might need to balance a little that way. And personally, for 10 years I did the questioning, which worked for me and was a good method, though it was a little intense. And then when I discovered the mindfulness, I said, that's a nice method too. And then actually, personally, I can put the two together. And I think it's really kind of help the two together, actually. So I think, personally, I see all these different things are complementary. Though also being a little according to temperament. Yes?
Could you tell shortly about the method of labeling? It's not very familiar.
It's not very familiar to me either. Okay. Because you see, I have never done it. And I don't think it would suit me because I have tried it in different ways and it really doesn't work for me. But I have lots of friends who've done it and really benefited from it. So basically, it's naming. So basically, you just kind of, they do it in different ways, but often it's to name your thought. Planning, daydreaming, ruminating, judging, or seeing, or hearing. So you can basically name what is going on. And I think as a means to recognize what's happening, because generally we're lost in them. And so in a way, if you label, if you name, then you become more aware of it. And then a lot of people find that method quite useful. Personally, it doesn't work for me. It makes me tense. So, but other people find it useful because it helps them to see more clearly what's going on. Yeah.
This just came to my mind. You practiced meditation for a very long time. Why do you meditate?
Me?
Yeah.
First, I must say that I generally don't meditate at all. It has to be quite clear. And so the only place I meditate is when.
Giving the money back.
Yeah, exactly. So I meditate. I mean, I meditate sitting, generally when I teach retreat, because then I'll do the meditation with everybody else. Otherwise, I meditate when I'm lying down in bed at night. That's one way I meditate. Or I meditate when I stand in the queue in the supermarket, or when I drive. I meditate also when I drive. So I found that the way I meditate is less in terms of formal meditation and more of informal meditation. So it's kind of what I would call active mindfulness. Then in terms of like sitting meditation on retreat, like for example here where I sit with you and I'm doing the job too, why do I sit? Just to do it. Because you see, I really, I think at one point, and I think that's where the great faith come in. The great faith is not this heroic stuff, here I go, I'm going to be awakened and things like that. But the great faith happen when actually you stop telling yourself, I am meditating to get this or that. And that you actually meditate just to do it. Just in a way, because you've in a way experienced the benefit of it, but you don't need to convince yourself anymore that it's a good idea, because you've experienced it yourself. So when I meditate, I just do it for its own sake. Just to be mindful, just to sit there, just to cultivate anchoring, and being aware. That's all. Just to do it for itself, not for some mega reason. And so I think this is, in a way, the shift that happens. I saw it in myself, the shift from doing it to get something to just do it to do it. And then it has, in a way, its own taste, its own momentum. My teacher, Master Kuzan, a Korean master, many years ago, we were traveling together in the West, in America. And so we would be in the plane, we would be in the train, and he would sit in meditation. And he would say to me, sit. And I would be like, I'm too tired, you know. I don't have the energy. He would be. And then he would sit, but then he would do this. So I would say to him, but Master, you know, don't you think it'd be nice to lie down and then you would be not so tired? I said, no. It has a different taste when you sit. It has a better taste. And I think it's the same. I think there is a certain taste that comes from sitting in meditation. There is a certain taste to the meditation. And I think that's also one reason one does it, because there is this taste of. In one text, they talk of feeling tone, and they talk about the worldly feeling tone and unworldly feeling tone. And I don't want to go into this kind of magical thing. But I think that when they talk of unworldly feeling tone, I think they're talking about the pleasant feeling tone you experience when you are mindful, when you meditate. And so it doesn't mean that it's fun all the time, every day. But after a while, there is a taste to it. There is a certain something to it. And so in a way, you do it just to do it because you experience that feeling, that awareness, which personally I think can be quite beneficial to build, in a way, the power of the awareness, the power of the kindness, the power of the stability. Yes?
One thing about labeling, you said that it's like one of the techniques.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought like each meditation practice includes labeling because this is how we achieve this clarity. You mentioned, for instance, you noticed that your thoughts were quite often related to yourself. So I think, could you say something more about that? Like, because I am not sure whether I understood. Because for me, each meditation practice is about naming our thoughts. Okay, I think about this. This thought is about that.
Well, this is, in a way, the labeling technique is that. It's naming what you think, for example, or what you feel, or what you experience.
Yes.
And so it's what I would call, I think, the one has to see the difference between a specific technique and what I would call a generalized mindfulness or generalized clarity. So as a technique, the labeling you would do all the time because that's a technique. In the same way that if I do the Korean Zen meditation as a technique, I question all the time and I don't do anything else, for example. And so in a way to see that part of the specific technique of labeling is what you describe, thinking, that kind of thinking, etc. That's part of that technique. But what I was saying in terms of when I was doing the questioning was that doing the questioning made me more aware. And as part of the generalized awareness, I became aware of my thought. But I was not every second, selfish thought, selfish thought. It was just a more generalized awareness about what I was thinking about, but not in a specific way. So I think each technique has kind of like a specificity that you can just do that. Or, of course, you can combine it with different things. And maybe we'll stop.